The MMQB podcast is brought to you by SeatGeek. Whether you're looking to buy tickets or sell tickets you can't use, check out SeatGeek, the smartest way to buy and sell tickets for your favorite sports team. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code MMQB for $20 off your first purchase. We're also sponsored by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football. Season-long fantasy is over, but on FanDuel, you can still play fantasy football for real cash, all the way to the Super Bowl. Enter our code TheMMQB at FanDuel.com to play a risk-free tournament for up to $10.
Well, let's see. I mean, you run the first 15 plays of your game, you see what they do against certain personnel packages, and if you feel like him being out there is something you can take advantage of, then maybe you do.
To me, this game, if the Broncos have a chance, it's going to come down to big plays. They're going to have one or two, I'm not going to say fluke, but really well-schemed 50, 60-yard gains that keep them in this. I'm Robert Klimko. We've also got the esteemed Andy Benoit here and the MMQB's newest hire, Robert Mays. This is your NFL Conference Championship Week podcast. I guess we've got one more to go after this. Do we do a post-Super Bowl podcast?
I mean, I think we have to do a post-Super Bowl podcast.
I mean, everybody will be so Super Bowled out. I guess there's the draft to talk about.
Yeah, there's no off-season, as they say, you know, and the combine is like, what, 2.5 weeks after the Super Bowl anyway?
Yeah. But
and then right after the combine, free agency happens. The fun never stops, really.
Well, before
look at Klimko. Klimko's been gone 3 weeks and already he's planning vacation for 2 weeks from now.
Well, before we get into all that, let's go over some of these coaching changes that we just saw this week. It's late news for some people, but I'm sure some will be interested in what we have to say on each of these. Robert, you were on the roundtable that we did for the MMQB, which will be on the site this week. And Peter asked us, you know, what we thought were good hires, what we thought were bad hires. Correct me if I'm wrong, Chip Kelly's named the 49ers coach. Did you like that one?
I didn't dislike it necessarily. I think a lot of these coaching hires are made generally with quarterbacks in mind. You know, the Adam Gase hire is made because you have substantial investment in Ryan Tannehill. And you want to say, what can we do to get the most out of Ryan Tannehill? It reeks of that to me. And you have Colin Kaepernick, who saw a lot of success as a quarterback with simple reads, play action, easy decisions where he didn't really have to sit back and navigate route trees and route progressions and things of that nature. And that's what Chip Kelly gives you in his offense. Outside of that, I'm not sure how much it fits, but if you're the 49ers, especially with your offensive personnel, it's not like you can't scrap it and start over. There aren't a lot of dudes in that huddle where it's like, this guy's untouchable, can't get away from him. So if you're looking for a guy to build something from the ground up offensively, Chip Kelly isn't exactly the worst option, because even if you had something built, he was just going to tear it down and start over anyway.
If anyone can save Kaepernick, in theory, it would be Chip Kelly, because, like you said, Mace, it's a simple system. It feels complex because it goes a million miles an hour, but the speed of it actually simplifies everything. You can't be complex if you're snapping the ball right away. So what look the defense gives you before the snap will almost always be the look you get after the snap. And with a guy like Kaepernick, that matters. That helps. And then, of course, there's the mobility factor. And Kelly has not had a mobile quarterback at the NFL level yet. Now he does. And I would expect his run game system to expand accordingly. Now, it's going to take some time, though, because as you said, Mace, there's nobody that's untouchable. It's not a very good roster. And looking at their offensive line, that's an offensive line that's below average and built for a gap scheme, built for pull blocking, move blocking, not a zone blocking unit by any means. So they're going to have to adjust some things under Kelly. They're going to have to change their personnel.
That's exactly what I was going to say. The man gap versus zone scheme, that's a huge deal. The thing is, though, the guys that really made that man zone or man gap scheme the defining trait of that 49ers offense, they're gone. Mike Iupati is gone. Anthony Davis is gone. And Alex Boone's a free agent. So the last holdover you have from those dominant gap-blocking offensive lines of those 49er teams of days gone by is Joe Staley. And he's actually a decently mobile big linemen. So he's somebody I think that can make the transition, but you're really looking to build that offensive line from scratch. And if he wants smaller, marginalized, low-priced guys like he enjoyed in Philadelphia, they're going to be there for him. That's the type of guys where he's going to have to change that line, but those guys are always available.
What was hilarious to me about this hire was that immediately after they took the Colin Kaepernick jerseys on 49ers.com off of the clearance section and restored the regular prices. So if anybody had given up on Cam, it started with Colin. It was the marketing department.
Here's the thing with Kaepernick is that when it went wrong with Bradford, that's a part of why Chip Kelly was fired, because that's the type of deal he wanted to make. If it goes wrong with Kaepernick, which they have a trapdoor out of that Kaepernick contract pretty much every single year, he can just say, well, I mean, what can we do with him? It wasn't my fault. He was a lost cause. So this gives him a lot more leeway than he had with his last quarterback rehabilitation project. And you mentioned that roundtable, Klemko, and when Peter asked us which ones we liked and didn't like, the one that I kind of hammered, which I feel is totally warranted, is Mike Mularkey getting hired as the Titans head coach. Mike Mularkey, thanks to our excellent researcher, John Daigle, is the 13th head coach in the Super Bowl era to have 3-plus jobs, and he has the worst winning percentage of all of them. I hate retread head coaches. It's one of the things that drives me the most crazy. And when I'm thinking of a retread head coach, Mike Mularkey is the guy. He's like the one I'm putting up on a pedestal. So this one drives me crazy. I don't know how you guys feel about it.
Well, I don't hate Mike Mularkey. I think there are retreads that work out every year. But you look at all the people they passed up on to hire Mike Mularkey. I mean, just the four coordinators, two coordinators in New England and two coordinators in Carolina. So the four coordinators in this NFC Championship game are all going to return as coordinators next year. And I think part of the reason that none of those guys get jobs is because their teams are so deep in the playoffs. There's no guarantee. You have to work out some kind of deal with a guy the way Atlanta did Dan Quinn and have some reassurance that, yes, that guy's going to take that job. But to hire Mike Mularkey when you have so many young and talented coordinators who have never had head coaching jobs, Terrell Austin comes to mind as well. I mean, it's uninspiring. And the first thing you want to do as an organization with the number one pick is restore confidence in your brand. To me, this does nothing to restore confidence in the Tennessee Titans.
Yeah, imagine Josh McDaniels with Marcus Mariota. I mean, that would be an exciting combination. I wonder what Mularkey's did. I wish contracts for coaches were more available, because I wonder if this was a little bit of a financial decision on the part of Titans ownership, which, by the way, is the NFL's trying to force out right now, and maybe that factors in as well, because this feels like almost a convenient hire.
I totally agree with that. And this is a situation where they really need John Robinson to be a home run for them, because they need something to change there. If they're willing to go along with the status quo in the coaching ranks, they better hope that personnel department gets a lot better. And the fact that he says, I'm willing to trade the number one pick. Thanks, John. Thanks for the newsflash. You have a quarterback and you're willing to trade the number one pick? I'm so surprised. I'm really glad you put that out there so everyone knows.
Well, what's he supposed to put out there, though, Maze? I mean, he's talking to the rest of the league as well as his fan base, so he's... Everybody that owns the number one pick at some point says, yeah, we'll listen to all offers. We'll look to trade. And he's just playing the game a little early.
Oh, I know. I mean, there's no game to be played. Everyone knows that he'd be listening to offers for the number one pick. If somebody called him for the number one pick, I'm sure he's listening. Like, we all know that.
I mean, the ideal result is the Rams RG3 trade, where you get to build your franchise with all of these later round picks and they get a boom or bust, pick like Robert Griffin. I think with that precedent set, that's the absolute maximum that you're going to get for the number one or number two pick in return, what the Rams got from Washington.
There's no doubt. It's just that I don't, first of all, with the way that worked out with the Robert Griffin trade, I would really doubt, outside of just an absolute home run quarterback of Andrew Luck's caliber, that we see a trade like that again in the next very long time. But when you don't need a quarterback like the Titans don't, and you need so many other pieces, of course you're willing to trade one piece for a ton more. Like, I mean, that's a given. We know that teams are willing to trade the number one pick these days when there isn't that generational quarterback talent available. That's the way it always will be.
So do you think the price for that pick gets driven down because everybody knows the Titans already have Mariota?
Absolutely. I mean, people know they don't want it, and he just said he doesn't want it. So it's obvious he's already in a position where he's negotiating from weakness. It's not going to be the type of Robert Griffin haul. It's going to be much, much less than that, and it should be much, much less than that.
Except you got to keep in mind the Browns, who pick right behind them, and we're going to talk about their coaching change next, they clearly need a quarterback. So that could almost, I would think, spike the price back up, is whoever gets the number one pick, they're doing it to beat out Cleveland, because you can't, if you don't take the number one pick, you're stuck with at least the 3 or 4, which means you're not controlling your own quarterback situation. And if there's a QB who separates himself come this offseason, and I don't know anything about the guys other than Jared Goff, and I wouldn't be surprised if he does separate himself, then it changes the whole equation. This draft talk is going to swing like a pendulum every week for the next, 4 months now?
That's a really good point. And when I'm talking about this, it's in my mind, I don't see that guy, but maybe somebody does separate from the pack a little bit when we get there. But let's not dig too far into that right now. That's way, way, way down the line. But we're talking about the Browns, and you mentioned the fact that they have the number two pick. Hugh Jackson came out and said, if there's a quarterback there, they're going to go get him because they need one. And that makes total sense. That's not a surprise at all. That's not that big of news. But just the Hugh Jackson hire in general, what are you guys thinking about him in this kind of second go around after what happened in Oakland?
I think that a lot of people talked about Josh McDaniels and how the process and how everything shook out with his first head coaching job in Denver really humbled him. You don't hear the same talk about Hugh Jackson. He doesn't strike me as a person who suffers fools lightly. So you put a guy who was rumored to have, or was, I guess his reputation is he has got a volatile personality, in a situation like Cleveland where it's been nothing but a disaster, any GM, any head coach they bring in there. And I don't know if that's because of the ownership structure or just bad luck. But you put a guy in that situation, I think you have to temper your optimism. At the same time, I think this whole thing with Hugh hinges on drafting the right quarterback at number two. And I would not be surprised if there's some big rumors that somebody's going to jump up to that number one spot and take the guy Hugh wants if Hugh actually makes that deal to flip-flop from 2 to 1. Because he knows, he's been in the NFL a long time now, he knows that your entire career, your entire prospects as a head coach revolve around the quarterback that you strap your wagon to.
I think it does, it does come down to the quarterback scenario. And I hope Hugh Jackson has a considerable say in personnel department there, because they don't have any football guys up there. And Jimmy Haslam factored into the Johnny Manziel decision and got exactly what he deserved. And Jimmy Haslam's fired coaches before it's plausible for them to have any sort of a chance to build a system. Jimmy Haslam's been the worst owner in the NFL by a wide margin right now. He's right behind whoever the dumbest stockholder for the Packers is. And so I think I was surprised they got Hugh Jackson, because Hugh Jackson, to me, was one of the premium head coaches out there. I would have thought he had his pick of places. So maybe I'm wrong. I'm surprised Jackson would take the Browns job, quite frankly. I hope it works out. Klemko, where'd you hear about the volatile personality? Because that's not necessarily what I've heard from Jackson, and certainly not with my interactions with him. But you're right, he doesn't suffer fools lightly. That's a good way to put it. But have you heard something I haven't?
No, nothing like Tom Cable punches a guy in the jaw and breaks his face. I mean, he doesn't suffer fools lightly. The guy is not going to put up with a whole bunch of crap from Jimmy Haslam and that management.
Well, let's move on from the Browns for now, and let's get to a situation that, among all the teams in the league, was one of the most stable, I mean, for the last however long, with Tom Coughlin being the head man in for the Giants. And now they're looking to maintain some of that stability. I mean, they're promoting from within. They're bringing in Ben McAdoo as the head coach. I don't know how you guys feel about this one. This is interesting to me. I understand where you would want to have some sort of steadying hand from that Coughlin era, but it's never as if Ben McAdoo has struck me as the guy who's the sort of personality, the sort of person you want in charge of your football team. And I will admit this pretty fully, I think it's like 90% because of the way he looks. He looks like somebody that's always a tool. He looks like a tool time extra from Home Improvement. Like he's like a knockoff version of what was Tim Allen's assistant in that in the show?
Al.
Not him. Oh, Al. He looks like a knockoff Al from Home Improvement, which I know that's mean, but God, that man, he lives in New York, and I'm sure he makes a substantial amount of money. He needs a new barber.
I agree. I spent time with Jeff Schwartz. We went to NFL Films when I was back east in December, and the first thing I said to him when we got in the car was, tell me about your offensive coordinator's wardrobe. What in the hell is going on there? And he said, yeah, he gets his own apparel, like stuff that we don't see anywhere. He gets like his own big baggy shirts and big baggy coats. And that's a mystery within the Giants organization as well. And I wonder if he'll continue to do that as a head coach, or if he'll at least like button the top of his shirt up or something.
I mean, it looks like he buys his jeans at a pharmacy. Like, it's unbelievable. He might be the least fashionable human being I've ever seen, and I've been around Jim Harbaugh before.
The mustache is a factor, too, in all of this. The mustache factors.
Full disclosure, I have a mustache right now, so I'm not one to talk about that.
Well, yeah, but we all know there are brands of mustaches, and you have dark hair, I believe, so that also adds a little definition or oomph to the mustache. He's more of a fair-haired gentleman, and it's not a prominent mustache. It looks like he forgot to wipe something off his face, and maybe I'm going to regret saying this now.
Can I ask you guys what you think about the actual hire? Because personally, I wasn't too excited about it. I mean, you bring in a guy, yes, his offense was pretty solid this year. I mean, not especially diverse. It was Odell Beckham or nothing. Probably the worst or second worst defense in football. And so instead of going out and getting a defensive-minded head coach, a guy you promote from a defensive coordinator spot, you retain your offensive coordinator and you hire Steve Spagnuolo, whose last coordinator gig was in New Orleans when he had the 32nd-ranked defense in the NFL. It's just none of it makes sense to me.
Well, I think Spagnuolo's had some really bad luck, though. In New Orleans, he had almost every cornerback. It may have been in St. Louis, actually. He had, because it was unfortunate how things worked out there. But he had almost every cornerback get injured. And then in New Orleans, there were a variety of factors that went into that, starting with the personnel. And that Saints defense hasn't been any good since he left either. I like Spagnuolo. I think he's an excellent coach. And I thought he did a lot with very little this year, or at least he did some with very little. The Giants probably had the least talented defense in the NFL, and there were games where they were still competitive on the strength of their defense.
I gave my opinion. That's exactly what I think about it.
which is what? That you don't like McAdoo's clothing?
That's really it. I've lost confidence. I've lost all the faith that I need to have.
The other thing to keep in mind, Eli Manning, the last two seasons, has had a quarterback rating of 92 or better. And I believe he hasn't done that a lot in his career. He's only done 93 two other times. He's Eli Manning, basically, and he's been over 4,400 yards. He's had the best two seasons of his career under Ben McAdoo. So the Giants have to take that in consideration. I think it's a little bit of a Dirk Cutter factor here. Ben McAdoo may have been getting some flirtations from other teams around the league, and the Giants didn't want to risk compromising the continuity they've built with their quarterback and the system he's in, just like the Bucs didn't want to do it with Jameis Winston. Now, Manning's old, Winston's young, but you still want continuity if you feel like you've got the right quarterback. And so they made the decision to hold on to McAdoo, and they're going to bank on Manning's leadership and bank on keeping things rolling. I think it's that McAdoo's stock was quietly rising around the NFL more than it may have been to people like us on the outside.
And then, now, I have some questions.
I don't disagree with that.
I have some questions about that, because the Eagles came out and said that they weren't ready to hire, or they weren't prepared to offer anybody except for Doug Peterson. But right after McAdoo was promoted, it was justified by Philly media, who reported that the Eagles were very close to hiring Ben McAdoo. Now, whether or not that was the case, do you hire McAdoo thinking that if he doesn't get a job this year, he's going to get a job the next year, so we might as well make him happy now? Or do you get yourself a defensive head coach, string McAdoo along a little bit longer as you groom some offensive assistants, and then maybe hope that you can promote a quarterback coach or something like that and get that continue that continuity?
Well, who would be the defensive head coach? Because in that scenario, you're talking about getting rid of Steve Spagnuolo, and my guess is a lot of people within the Giants organization appreciate Spags.
Yeah, I guess maybe not necessarily a defensive head coach, but a guy with a little bit more of a pedigree in running an organization than Ben McAdoo.
Maybe like a Tom Coughlin or something.
All right, let's move on, or else we're going to be here for like 8 hours.
You really have nothing else to say on the topic, Nate.
I'm trying to be the host here. I agree with you in a way, Andy. I think that their offense has been quietly solid without often a right to be. Their offensive line has been really hurt. I mean, they brought Jeff Schwartz in as a free agent signing I really liked. He goes down for, you know, two of the three seasons he's there pretty much. Will Beattie is the guy they wanted to play left tackle. They never envisioned Eric Flowers being there this year. That became kind of a mess. And they were able to sustain offense even when they probably shouldn't have been able to. And I think that was a lot on the back of Eli Manning and Odell Beckham. And I think that if you want that to be the centerpiece of your team and you already have seen it have success with one person kind of running the show, then I don't hate the hire. I think that it makes sense if you track it that way. All right, guys, staying in the division, Doug Peterson is named the Eagles coach. I actually really liked this one. I feel like if you're looking at the way that Kansas City team without a lot of high-level talent outside of Jeremy Maclin and Travis Kelce was still able to build offense, manufacture yards, I think the Eagles are going to have to do the same thing, and you're going to need to get creative, and it feels to me like Doug Peterson, after learning at Andy Reid's hip for so long, is a guy that's going to be able to help build that sort of team. I don't know how you guys feel.
Well, there are some who are concerned, and I'm not saying I'm in this camp. I'm just saying what I've heard. There are some who are concerned because they're saying Doug Peterson has not really been promoted much throughout his short NFL coaching career, and he was never given a chance to call plays. And I know he works for Andy Reid, but when Andy Reid had Marty Morningwig in Philadelphia for a little while there, Morningwig for a bit of that time was calling the plays. So I don't know if there's any concern to that or any validity to that. It's hard to know on all these things. Jenny Wrench has wrote an excellent piece today on head coaching interviews and all that goes into that stuff. And that's just the interview process. The actual hiring process and what we know about these guys, I think, can be very limited. So my guess is the Eagles are comfortable with Peterson because of their familiarity with Andy Reid, and it's probably a personal thing as much as anything.
Can you guys think of a recent head coach with such a precipitous rise as Doug Peterson? I mean, is the last time back in 2008, Doug Peterson was a head coach at Cavalry Baptist Academy. And then he gets the quality control job in Philadelphia, then quarterbacks coach, then OC in Kansas City, and then the Eagles job. I mean, I can't think of a guy with less experience than that.
This is going to be a weird answer, but somebody who had a pretty precipitous rise in the head coaching ranks is Jim Harbaugh.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the coach at the University of San Diego, and then 7 years later, he was the best coach in the NFL. I mean, that's not a really long track record.
And the one thing Harbaugh has in common with Peterson was he was an NFL quarterback. We saw the young guys. We saw Mike Tomlin, and then because of his success, Raheem Morris got a quick look. Josh McDaniels got a very quick look. Those guys were in their early 30s, which at the time I was in my late teens or early 20s, so it didn't feel young to me. But now in my late 20s, I'm thinking, my gosh, early 30s is sure very young to be an NFL head coach. Peterson's 43, though, so his rise was a different path, but he played in the NFL into his 30s.
I don't know. Yeah, early 30s isn't that young to be an NFL head coach. I think I could be an NFL head coach right now. I don't turn 29 until August.
Yeah. You could be a Major League Baseball third base coach. Maybe.
No, I would be terrible at that job, mostly because I would refuse to wear those pants under no circumstances.
you're not gonna suit up in your uniform.
That is the stupidest thing. We wrote about this at Grantland once. Wesley Morris, who is maybe my favorite writer in America, just absolutely hammered this idea that the coaches would wear the uniform of the players. It is really the dumbest thing that we perpetuate in American sports. I just have absolutely no use for it, but that's a whole different story.
Baseball has a handful of really what amount to embarrassing quirks, I would say. I mean, I think there's like 8 or 9 things equivalent in baseball to why in the hell is the coach wearing the uniform?
All right, well, we'll save that for another podcast. We'll save, you know, coaching fashion choices, which we've really talked a lot about today, for an entirely separate episode of this. But while we're talking about the Chiefs, let's get into a few of the teams that kind of got bounced from the playoffs this week. And let's start with those Kansas City Chiefs. I mean, I think that a season that was really one of maybe the best case scenario for them, looking at the run of success they had with the amount of talent they did, their defense really coalesced by the end. It became the defense we saw a couple of years ago. I mean, if you're the Chiefs, you're looking at next season, where do you go from here?
I think you go find a wide receiver again. With Jeremy Maclin out of the lineup, New England played man-to-man coverage on him on every snap, and they spied Alex Smith, and those two things alone were enough to derail the offense. I know Kansas City had the ball a long time, and they were able to get first downs. That offense never functioned the way it wanted to in that game, and it's such a highly schemed offense. They're so dependent on winning through play design. I think you find another wide receiver or another playmaker, maybe Jamaal Charles being healthy can be the difference, but they flat out need more talent if they're going to have a quarterback like Alex Smith game managing, which is exactly what he does.
I think you also go for a little bit more depth at the outside linebacker spot. I still, for, you know, the second year in a row, don't think D Ford belongs anywhere on a starting defense in the playoffs. And he's the guy taking most of the snaps for them in the outside linebacker rotation after the starters.
I was going to say, this is the first time in a long time where they've kind of been out of the woods cap-wise. I mean, they've been up against it the last couple years because of just kind of old deals that really came back to bite them. They were still paying Dwayne Bowe in the realm of $8 million in dead money this year. And they have right now, as of today, about $122 million on their cap. And that's the most they've had in considerable amount of time. You know, that's the work of John Dorsey kind of righting the wrongs of a previous regime.
So, do you think he'll spend it, though? Do you think he'll spend? John Dorsey comes from Green Bay. And
it's a great question.
You'd have that mindset a little bit. And if you look at this Chiefs roster, it's full of guys that they drafted themselves. There are very few free agent pickups. The only one of any meaning at all that I can see who plays is Sean Smith and Jeremy Maclin.
And well, that's the thing. The Jeremy Maclin signing is the type of thing the Green Bay Packers would never do. So we're already, in just one season of him having a tiny bit of money, John Dorsey has stepped out of Ted Thompson's shadow in terms of how he's approaching his job. So I wouldn't be surprised if they use that money to make a Jeremy Maclin-esque signing, maybe somewhere on the offensive line, just a place where they could use an upgrade and there are players that are in that affordable range, even at a tier a little bit less than Jeremy Maclin. You know, actually, you know what? Speaking of Ted Thompson, speaking of the Packers, let's go there next. I mean, this is a team that really, that game against Washington felt like kind of an outlier compared to what they'd look like in the second half of the season. And then somehow they push Arizona to the brink. I mean, I really don't know what to make of them in so many ways. But again, the same question. If you're Green Bay, what is your offseason move? What is your offseason focus?
Well, I'd like to find a legitimate tight end threat. I've never been super impressed with Richard Rodgers as a blocker, as a receiver, really just overall. And I think the one thing that was exciting about JerMichael Finley when he was a young and up-and-coming player was he really seemed to open up that offense and give Aaron Rodgers a safety valve that he doesn't really have with Richard Rodgers. So if I'm them, I'm either spending a draft pick, a high draft pick on one of these tight ends or going after one in free agency.
Yeah, Green Bay, for a team that struggled as much as they did, they don't have a ton of needs because Jordy Nelson will be back. My guess is he'll be healthy and good to go because that's how ACL injuries tend to go anymore, and he injured his in August, so he'll have had a full calendar year once the season starts. A lot's going to depend on how they feel about Davante Adams and Ty Montgomery in the offseason. Those young receivers need to develop. They have a lot of learning to do. And I don't think you resign James Jones. You've already got Randall Cobb locked up. If your young wide receivers can take a step forward, and that's a big if, then I think the passing game is fine. A tight end would be nice. So, but Green Bay's in a position where they can really draft for depth and for future need because they don't have anything particularly pressing along their front line, other than maybe D tackle, because Raji and LaTroy Guyon are both free agents.
Yeah, they're going to need somebody in the middle of that defense. They just signed Mike Daniels long-term, but he's not a nose of any sort. So that's a position where I think that they would try to go a little bit cheaper if they could. I would like to see where Jake Ryan develops to see if they can maybe get him a few more snaps and allow Clay Matthews to move back outside. But, yeah, it's the receiving options, too, and not only the development of the younger ones and maybe an upgrade at tight end. I think Mike McCarthy needs to take a long look in the mirror this offseason and think, are we going to be this pretty straightforward, you know, the opposite of what Andy Reid likes to do? Because that is, it's fine and dandy when you have Jordy Nelson, Randall Cobb, and Aaron Rodgers playing quarterback and no injuries to your offensive line. But you can't build your team as if you're going to have the same personnel through the entire season. You need to be a little bit more flexible than that and a little bit more nimble than that. And I hope that they take steps forward in that direction this offseason, because watching what Aaron Rodgers had to deal with for most of this year, I don't want him having to deal with that. I want to have him in the position where he's able to succeed the most, because that's when football is the most fun. All right, let's move on to their NFC counterpart on the losing end this weekend, Seattle Seahawks. I mean, I don't know what to say about Seattle in terms of what they may or may not need. I think it really starts and ends in one place. And their offensive line is a mess. Russell Okung is a free agent, so that's another thing they're going to have to consider. They have a decent amount of cap room, considering how many guys they've recently signed to big deals. That is going to jump up even more if they cut Marshawn Lynch, which seems like kind of an inevitability at this point. Outside of that offensive line and not making Russell Wilson run for his life every single game, is there anything you guys can think of when it comes to Seattle?
I mean, that offensive line is the glaring weak spot for me. Out of all the teams in the NFL, I think they spend the least on the offensive line outside of Russell Okung's monster contract, the one that came before the 2011 CBA that restructured the rookie pool. I think they're in a great position to go after some of these guys that are going to hit the free agent market. I mean, the Bills are probably franchise Cordy Glenn, but if not, that would be an incredible pickup. Russell Okung is average. But to me, you could make the argument that he should still be retained just because of the shape the rest of that offensive line is in.
I think you could make that argument when he came in the league in 2010. But now with the salary cap limit, or with the contract limitations, the ceiling on first-round rookies, you could probably find a cheaper Russell Okung through the draft if you're willing to go that route. I agree with you guys. Offensive line is an issue. Jeremy Lane, Deshaun Shedd are free agents. One of them at least needs brought back. Bruce Irvin, what do you do with him? My guess is somebody's going to pay him more money elsewhere. Guys like Atlanta, for example, which I believe he's from Atlanta, and has played in that scheme under Dan Quinn, they could really use him. Ataya Rubin, Brandon Mebane are free agents. It's a matter of mostly re-signing your own guys. Anytime we get to these divisional round teams, these discussions are going to be limited because they're inherently talented. I mean, the next up's Pittsburgh Steelers, and my answer for this question, what do they need to do, is going to be absolutely nothing at all. I think their defense is on the rise and their offense is the scariest I've ever seen. So I don't know how many needs the Packers, Chiefs, and especially Seahawks or Steelers have.
I totally agree. With Seattle, I see them doing something similar to what Carolina did in 2013, where they said, what do we need? And they just threw all of their weight at defensive tackle. And they picked two of them in two consecutive rounds, and it went a long way in transforming them as a team and really made them a complete defense. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if Seattle made a similar choice. If in the first and second round they took a tackle and a guard and then spent a little bit of money on a cheaper one in free agency and said, this is a brand new unit, let's go. And if I were them, that's exactly what I would do. So, and maybe add a little corner depth here and there. But you're right, Andy. We're nitpicking a little bit. And in that same vein, going to Pittsburgh, I think that they need their defensive backs to be a little bit younger, and they need those guys to get a little bit better and to develop. Senquez Golson missed the entire season with a shoulder injury. This guy they picked in the second round last year. Hopefully he can contribute for them. You know, William Gay, I think, is going to be 34. William Gay is 31. Will Allen's 34. So they need a little bit of youth injected into that secondary. But outside of that, Kelvin Beachum is a free agent. That's a decision you're going to have to make. But you get Le'Veon Bell back. It's really, that's a team where you just need to be on the track you're on. You don't need to make any huge changes.
Yeah, I think
it's something to keep in mind. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Robert.
No, it's just I think you're right. They do need to get younger at defensive backfield, and I think they've got to replace a couple guys. Lawrence Timmons, Antoine Blake. I mean, he's not an old guy. He was a UDFA in 2012, but just watching him towards the back end of this season, I think he was a bit of a liability for them. And if they had made it to this next round against New England, I think he really would have got exposed.
Yeah, and his contract's up anyway, so they could let him go easily. Brandon Boykin's contract's up. William Gay's contract is up. Will Allen's contract is up. Now, Will Allen and Gay are two guys that tend to find their way back into the Steelers lineup. And I think the reason that Pittsburgh wants to be young, theoretically, every team wants to be young. But one area where Pittsburgh hasn't had trouble getting away with being old, or they don't seem to mind, is the secondary, because they do so many things with matchup zones that they really need smart guys more than they need athletes back there. And that's not true for most secondaries. Cornerback is by far the most, has the highest percentage of number one draft picks of all defensive positions in the NFL, because that's where the best athletes play. But in Pittsburgh's scheme, it's the smart guys first. And so they like guys they can trust. You can also find these smart guys in the middle rounds. They're not, you don't have to take one in the first round because he's not going to need to run a 4-3. So for a team that has a need at cornerback, it's a pretty soft need. It's a pretty manageable need for them to address.
I totally agree. But the thing about smart old guys is they get old real fast. Troy Polamalu got old real fast. When you're playing with 34-year-old dudes, you're playing with a lot of wiggle room. That is not a huge margin for error. So I understand what they're doing when you're doing that, but I still think that you're living a little bit dangerously.
I'm going to take a second to tell you about SeatGeek before we get to the championship matchups. After the mayhem and drama of last weekend's NFL divisional games, who's to know what's going to happen this weekend in the championship rounds? If you want to go see what happens in person, use the SeatGeek app. SeatGeek pulls all the ticket buying and selling options from other ticket sites into one place to save you time. SeatGeek also knows the fair market value of every ticket. They use that information to show you the best deals and help you find underpriced seats. If you have tickets you can't use, SeatGeek will help you quickly sell them to another fan. SeatGeek has the lowest fees of any ticket site out there and always shows you the full price up front. So, for the SeatGeek app, download it now today. It's free. Use our promo code MMQB in the app. If you do that, SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. For the NFL playoffs, the NBA, the best concerts, the SeatGeek app, our promo code MMQB, you get $20 off your first purchase.
Going to live football games is fun, guys. It really is. Both Klemko and I were in Denver last week, and even though it was kind of a stinker for most of the game, it was definitely worth being there to see how it all went down. And I don't know about you, Klemko, and just looking at that team and seeing what they looked like against Pittsburgh, I felt like in a lot of moments, Pittsburgh was the better team, and when healthy, they definitely would have been a better team. And that does not bode well for the Broncos having to face Tom Brady and a Patriots team that is way healthier than they were at most points of this year.
They're healthy at the right time, and I walked away from this game thinking New England's going to be a 7-point favorite. They're going to be a favorite by a touchdown in the AFC Championship, and we are doomed to another Super Bowl week of dour Bill Belichick press conferences and very careful podium talk from the rest of that roster. I'm not encouraged by the Broncos. I think Peyton Manning and that offense are way too conservative because of what he is able or not able to do. You watch the Patriots, Peyton, we're going to talk about this a little later, but Tom Brady getting the ball out of his hands seemingly as soon as he catches it. I mean, it doesn't even look like he gets his fingers on the laces. And before you know it, Julian Edelman is 15, 20 yards downfield. I see this being a blowout. I could be wrong. I think the Denver defense is great. It's probably the best in the NFL at this point. But you've got Chris Harris sidelined with a shoulder injury. He's going to be coming in as a slot corner with Bradley Roby on the outsides. I just see too many weaknesses for New England to exploit.
Well, do you have any sunshine to add here, Benoit? Or is this the tone this is going to take?
Well, for the sake of discussion, let me take the Broncos side and argue the Broncos side then. they beat New England earlier this year, and they beat them running the ball effectively. I mean, I think they had 180 yards rushing, something like that. I mean, they ran effectively when they needed to. They will run the ball out of multi-tight end sets, and the Patriots are – they're a good run defense, but they're also going to be playing at altitude late in the season. They haven't been substituting in their front seven quite as much lately. The game, I think, comes down to that on that side of the ball, because what Robert said is right. The passing game in Denver is totally different, and they're not as good at receivers they were in past years. And New England's secondary is just tremendous in man coverage or whatever kind of coverage they want to run. So I don't see Denver dropping back and throwing for 300 yards in this game. It's going to come down to the run. On the other side, so much of it depends on how you approach Gronkowski, because how you approach him impacts how you can approach Edelman. And Edelman's the key. We saw that. It's a totally different offense with him in there versus when he's out of the lineup. Totally different. He's as valuable as anyone in the league almost, because they give him, he gives them that quick strike element and the spread formations and the pre-snap motion and all the things that make the Patriots dangerous and make Tom Brady able to get the ball out quickly. I think if you just line up and play man-to-man, that's not going to work. For one, Denver's hasn't been as effective in man coverage lately. And for two, no matter how good you are in man, there are certain elements that can defeat you by the nature of football and scheme and tactics, and New England has mastered those. So what do you do? Who do you put on Gronkowski? Do you put a safety on him? Do you leave Aqib Talib out there on him? I'd like to see that. When Gronkowski splits out wide, that's when the Patriots are their toughest. That's when they beat or they gave Denver trouble last time. I think you got to answer that question now if you're the Broncos.
And I think this is where you run into problems, because every situation you just laid out there for me, I don't like the answer. And if you're the Broncos defense, which is the strength of what they do, I don't think you're going to be good enough against this New England team to buoy your entire team like they were last week against Pittsburgh. And let's start with a couple of those things. So they played a lot of zone against Pittsburgh last week. And that was possible because Antonio Brown didn't play. Antonio Brown and Julian Edelman are not the same player, but they represent a similar challenge in some ways. And they allow their offenses to do similar things. Again, shout out to John Daigle. The Broncos pressured Roethlisberger on 47.5% of his dropbacks last week. Brady was not pressured at all against Kansas City. Brady's release time last week was 2.13 seconds. It was 2.45 when Julian Edelman was hurt. It just allows the decision-making to be quicker. And that's going to be the case again with Edelman in there. And especially if they play man on Edelman and he's roasting people at the snap, that's going to be more of an option. So that really negates those pass rushers for the Broncos that are what makes their defense so incredibly dangerous. So with Chris Harris out of this game, and even if he is in the game being limited, there's just no way I can build the situation in my mind where the Broncos can stifle the Patriots enough to keep the score artificially low enough for the offense of Denver to score enough points to win the game, if that all makes sense.
The only thing that I would say to that is that Kansas City, I think, abandoned any hope of getting any pressure on Brady with, you know, stunts or blitzes or anything like that. It was pretty much straight up three or four guys rushing the passer and them sitting back and letting Brady pick them apart. I don't see Wade Phillips, son of bum, after watching that game, sit back and let Brady just, you know, squeeze one into Edelman, squeeze one in over the top to Gronkowski. I see him coming with a little bit more pressure than teams have here in the playoffs.
Yeah, but do you want to blitz Tom Brady?
Yeah, I think you got to threaten the pressure. I think you got to give different looks and make Brady account for that and adjust the protection, which is something Kansas City did not do. Bringing the pressure is different than threatening it. It can have the same effect, though. But those 2.13 seconds, that's not something you can necessarily control defensively. You can try to impact it by showing them looks, but there's no blitz unless you're letting a guy come totally clean through the A-gap, which almost never happens. There's no blitz I can reach a quarterback in 2.13 seconds. And by the way, those 2.13, as a side note, those are run after catch throws as well. There's yards after the catch. Those 2.45 seconds, when Edelman was out, and he was out last time they played Denver, those are not so much run after the catch. Those are more sit routes, post patterns, slower developing type of plays with slower endings to them. So it's a totally different Patriot offense, as John Daigle's figured out for us, our researcher.
The Patriots, as a team, which is pretty much Brady, They had the second best passer rating in the league against blitzes this year. I mean, that's just – they're in a tough spot. And I'm like getting frustrated because I'm frustrated for them because they've been the best defense in the league all season. But they're injured at the wrong time. And this is one of those situations where we realize how much of an important player Chris Harris is. And I said – when I wrote about the Broncos today, I said him being hurt could mean the difference in them winning and losing the game. And part of the reason for that is because when you play this style the Broncos do now, where you need great defense, you need turnovers, you need big special teams plays, again, your margin for error is just so much less. And that margin for error can come down to a star player not being 100%.
Yeah, I think it could be one of those situations where Chris Harris has a heavy dose of Toradol before the game and he ends up playing the outside and they bring in Bradley Roby in the slot and to one of those ruses that you try to get Belichick to scheme for something that's not about to happen.
Hey, oh well, actually one other thing to keep in mind as well is New England, I wouldn't be surprised if they play two tight ends in this game instead of three wide receiver, because that will make Denver have to make a decision about what they do with their nickel defense. Denver's at their best in nickel when they've got all that speed on the field. They've got those three good quality cover corners. If you keep those guys in against two tight ends, then I think we will see New England attempt to run the ball and force the corners to be run force players. If you match up with three linebackers against two tight ends, they're going to throw the ball and you've got the mismatch with Gronkowski to keep in mind.
It's interesting. I understand where you're coming from with that, but I almost think they're going to do the opposite to get Harris on the field as much as they can have him out there. If he's a detriment when he's playing.
I don't think they're worried about Harris as much as you guys are. I wouldn't be. Chris
told me on Sunday that he can't be himself at this point. He's extremely frustrated.
Well, but what good does it do him to tell you the truth? He could tell you anything he wants right now. And I mean,
I don't see him
reporter.
Doing that.
I don't mean you personally.
He took himself out of the game on Sunday.
No, I get that he's limited, but it's not like he left the game. He didn't leave the game with an injury. And he was able to play through it a week ago. He's got a week to heal now. The way Bill Belichick perceives injuries, my guess is they're not going to view Harris as attackable.
Well, let's see. I mean, you run the first 15 plays of your game, you see what they do against certain personnel packages, and if you feel like him being out there is something you can take advantage of, then maybe you do. I mean, that's what the first quarter of a football game is for.
I think what New England likes, the reason I think they'll also go two tight end in this, or could, is because they're so versatile, a lot of two tight end. Their two tight end can act as a four receiver set if they want. They're not that good at, they're not receiver talented. But the way their offense is structured, they can still get away with that.
Yeah, I just think that having seeing what they're going to do with man coverage versus zone and everything else, the amount of miscommunications they had last week when they had to change personnel in the secondary, I think that's going to creep up. But on the other side of the ball, which I think we should talk about a little bit more, I agree that they're going to just try to sit there and hammer them in the run game. And that's one of the things that quietly allowed the Broncos to sustain wins and everything else in the second half. They were 26th in the league in yards per carry the first half of the season. They were 9th in the second half. And one of the problems I think they're going to run into is that, in my opinion, one of the ways they were able to do that is because Peyton Manning wasn't playing quarterback. And them being able to be under center a little bit more, watching that game against Pittsburgh, it really does look like those guys are more comfortable running the ball under center. And I just think that if they have Manning in there and they are apprehensive about doing that, I don't know how much success they're going to have against what is a pretty good run defense.
Yeah, and I think some of the things that New England was doing especially well against Kansas City will work in similar ways against Denver. I think on second down, first down, when you didn't know if it was run or pass, they often had a linebacker scraping over the top. It was Gerard Mayo, but he's out on IR. But, you know, it's sort of personnel agnostic. A linebacker scraping over the top, and if it's a pass, then he's got that hook curl bubble. And if it's or a delay blitz. And if it's a run, he's right there in position to stuff it up the middle. And I don't think they have to get real complicated to stop Peyton Manning and this offense. So, to me, this game, if the Broncos have a chance, it's going to come down to big plays. They're going to have one or two, I'm not going to say fluke, but really well-schemed 50, 60-yard gains that keep them in this.
And the other thing to keep in mind would be red zone, because New England does not want to give up big plays. They're a classic bend but don't break defense, and they'll let you move the ball in the middle of the field. I mean, they're not going to let you, but they can live with that because they believe that they can change things up on the red zone fringe and show you something, a wrinkle or something that you haven't quite seen yet, and beat you that way. Red zone offense is always key against a defense like that.
Before we move on to this last game, I want to tell you a little bit about one of our sponsors. Season-long fantasy leagues are done with for another year, but fantasy players don't have to wait another year to get in on the action. On FanDuel, you can play for cash all the way up to the Super Bowl. Now, when you play on FanDuel.com with our code, the MMQB, your first tournament is risk-free. That's any contest offered on FanDuel at up to $10. If you win, you keep the money. If you lose, they will refund your account. FanDuel is the best place to play one-week fantasy football. Building a team is easy and fun. Just pick your players and stay under the cap. Entry fees start at $1, so there's a league for everyone. Play against the world or create a listener league for your friends. It's a great way to keep in touch. You can also play basketball and hockey on FanDuel. That means you can play fantasy sports for cash on almost any night of the week. Think you know fantasy football? Come prove it at FanDuel.com. And here's our offer. If you enter a league and you don't win, FanDuel will refund your money. That's any contest you want, up to $10. You can sign up on FanDuel.com using our code, the MMQB, then make a deposit and choose your league. If you don't win, you'll get that money right back on your FanDuel account. FanDuel.com, where it can finally pay to be a fan.
All right, well, as unenthused as I kind of am about that AFC Championship game, I feel the opposite about what's about to happen in Charlotte this weekend. When I found out that I got to go to this game, I actually fist pumped, which, to be fair, if there's ever a moment in my professional career where I don't do that when I get to go to a conference championship game, I want someone to punch me in the face. But this one really does have juice to it that I'm very, very excited about. I don't know how you guys feel.
Well, you're talking about two teams that have combined to lose four games in the NFL this year. And for all the mediocre Thursday night football and Sunday night football and 1 o'clock start games that, you know, we watch all year, and obviously we're happy to get paid to watch them, this is the one that you really look forward to because there are not a lot of glaring weaknesses. When we're talking about weaknesses on the Pats or the Broncos, we're nitpicking just like we are with some of these teams and what they need when these teams that were denied deep in the playoffs. These are tiny faults for these guys that we say, you know, are going to get exploited in these games, could start in 32 places in the NFL. To me, the big loss for Carolina going into this, Jared Allen likely to miss the rest of the postseason. I think he was strong towards the end of the season. You know, he's not their best player on defense by any means, but against Carson Palmer, guys getting the ball quick out of his hands, has a ton of different receivers to go to. The better you can manufacture a pass rush with just three or four guys, the better off you're going to be.
And on that note, Arizona uses empty formations as much as any team in the NFL, and they ask their offensive line to survive in those. New England will go empty, but they get the ball out in 2.13 seconds, as we went over. Arizona is a deeper drop passing team. They're going to stretch to the intermediate levels, as Mays did a great job of explaining and detailing in his going long article a few weeks ago. And so that offensive line has to hold up against the Panthers. I think they've got guys that can replace Jared Allen if we're talking about just one game. Obviously, you'd rather have him in there than not. To me, the key is what can Carolina do against the downfield route combinations? Because if you know you're getting cover three or cover two, depending on the scenario, and that's what you're going to get from Carolina, I think Arizona's difficult to defend that way because they're so good with their route designs. A predictable coverage, to me, seems exploitable for them.
So this is the side of the ball about which I am more fascinated, and it happens on like 10 different levels. One, I think that Jaren Allen being out is not ideal, but it doesn't show up as much against Arizona because I feel like their tackles are much better than their interior offensive linemen and in the passing game. So I look at the way that Green Bay slowed down the Cardinals at points last week, and it's because Mike Daniels was absolutely beasting people. And the interior of that line was really winning one-on-one matchups. And against this team, they have a chance to lose them again because Kawan Short was the best player on the field, not named Luke Kuechly, for Carolina last week. And if he can take advantage of somebody like Ted Larson, a guy like Mike Iupati in the passing game, then that's going to be a problem. If you're pushing Carson Palmer off his spot, if you're making him move around, that's where you want to be. So I think just like they did against the Seahawks, they have a chance to win in some of those areas on Sunday. The other part that I find very interesting is that you don't want to throw the ball in the middle of the field against Carolina. You just don't want to do it. I mean, those guys eat up everything. So how are you going to create space and create matchups for yourself on the outside of the field? What do you do with Josh Norman if you're Carolina? Do you have him follow somebody around? Do you have him play one side? That part of it is fascinating to me, too. I am interested to see, especially this is kind of for you, Andy, and what you just said, what is Arizona going to do in terms of creating separation for some of those guys via design? I can see a lot of trips to one side and just having shots built into it that way. As much as it's hard to imagine a team throwing the ball all over Carolina, I still think the weakest part of their defense is if you can get time and make plays happen deep outside the numbers, those are going to be your best shots.
I agree with you full-heartedly, and I think the way they will set that up and get to it is out of condensed formations. The receivers align tight to the formation inside the field numbers. Larry Fitzgerald's very good there. When you go in those condensed sets, you widen the field and present more horizontal space for yourself. And you also compromise some of the spacing and the techniques that the defensive backs can play with just by the rules of football geometry. So Arizona's exceptional out of condensed sets, including out of empty. They don't just go empty formations and spread out like most teams. They'll go empty with two receivers tight to one side and trips to tight to the other. I think that's the key for them in this game.
Do you think it's foreboding in any way that David Johnson against the Packers rushed for just 38 yards on 18 carries? I mean, you watch that game, seemed like he's getting hit at the backfield, in the backfield or at the line of scrimmage every time he got the ball. And it's not like they gave up on trying to run the ball with him. I mean, consistently all game, they tried to get him going.
You know, I think
it's a problem in the same reason that I think that the interior of the Packers line won a lot in that game. And I think, absolutely, it could be a problem again. Because you're looking at the interior of a Carolina line when you look at that front seven that probably has more talent than Arizona's offensive line.
You know, I see Arizona's running game differently. I think they use it just as a complementary piece. They do it to stay balanced and keep defenses honest. They're not a running team. They don't put a lot of design and creativity into it. And, they had 32 yards, 18 runs. Green Bay was better him on the ground. Well, Arizona still won the game, and they probably would have won handily if Carson Palmer hadn't made some uncharacteristic mistakes in the red zone. So they're not at all afraid of third down and long in Arizona. So I think they'd like to run the ball. I think they'll probably give Johnson or whoever they want, that Andre Ellington, combine and give him 15 to 20 touches just to be on schedule. But I don't think Bruce Arians looks at running stats with a very close or scrutinized eye.
It's a really good point. I mean, it's just the idea of, similar to when you're a shooter in the NBA, it's just the threat of doing it, and that gives you, it creates spacing and everything else. The idea that they're going to run the ball every once in a while makes their play-action game more dangerous, and that's, in a lot of ways, how they want to attack you. So I think that's a good point. Let's go to the other side of the ball, and let's go to, we've talked about all this for so long, and we have not mentioned the probable MVP of the NFL, so... If you're building a case and you're building a game plan for the Panthers as to how they're going to attack Arizona, what do you guys think is on their minds?
Well, If I'm Mike Shula, I'm trying to figure out ways to get Greg Olsen involved early, to make him a factor immediately. Because I think when Olsen has linebackers and safeties worried about him, then you're able to slip in some of these running plays, some option runs, some draws that get more yards than they would have if you're facing more men in the box. So to me, key to this game, I mean, you look at Greg Olsen's last week, six catches, 77 yards and a touchdown. I think he needs to have a game like that or better.
I agree. And the other guy's Dixon, who is not a difference maker, but he's your number two tight end. And when these teams played in the wild card last year, And they're different now. Cam Newton's a better player. Arizona's probably not as talented defensively, but Arizona runs the same scheme. And the wild card, Dixon was a big part of the passing game because they used route combinations off of Greg Olsen to attack Arizona's downfield matchup coverage principles. And there's a bunch of nuances with it. But suffice it to say, if you run two vertical receivers at Arizona, Carolina feels comfortable doing that. And Dixon, they had a chance last year. Dixon and Newton didn't connect on a lot of plays that they should have. But tactically, Carolina outplayed Arizona in the wild card a year ago. I wouldn't be surprised to see a variation of that now, especially because Newton has gotten so much better in the pocket.
Tight end makes a ton of sense. And historically, it's been the way to attack Arizona's defense, even when they've been really good in other areas. This year, they were seventh in DVOA against tight ends. That's a huge improvement from where they've been in the past. I think that their safety rotation, the development of guys like Johnson and Jefferson, plus moving Buchanan down into there, has allowed them to be a little bit better in that area than they've been before. But obviously, the Carolina passing game, as you're building it from step one, it starts with him. I mean, he's your best receiver, and he's the guy you have to get going. So I think they're right in wanting to do that. I also think that this Arizona team is better set up to slow that down than they've been in the past.
And we're talking passing game, but I think we all agree Carolina has to run the ball first or foremost, totally. Don't they, in this one? I mean, I think if they don't have 150 yards on the ground, and I mean a good 150, not like last week where they got 60 early on and then didn't really get a whole lot after that. I mean, they need to have a sustainable rushing attack and keep Arizona in its base defense and really challenge those guys. You challenge a quick, undersized guy like Buchanan to make the right read very quickly, because if he goes in the wrong direction against their misdirection run plays, he's going to get smothered by bigger offensive linemen. Carolina tries to outsmart you in the ground game. I think that's how you need to go against these guys, especially with Kevin Minter and Buchanan being only such young guys in there.
Yeah, and not great run defenders. I mean, they run defend out of scheme as much as they run defend anything. So I totally agree. But at the same time, this is one of the best run defenses in the league. So it's not as if that's a glaring weakness. Arizona's a really good football team.
Yeah, they are. And you know, one reason they're so good, and I think it doesn't factor as much in this one, they're good on run defense because they do a lot of condensed defensive line concepts against zone running teams, where their D tackles will slide inside and both play in the three techniques, bare fronts, as people have come to know it. And they do a lot of different variations with that stuff. I'm not sure that matters as much against Carolina, because Carolina puts so many extra bodies in the run game. They'll have a fullback and a tight end. Against Seattle, they often had two tight ends and a fullback, went with 22 personnel. They're very heavy there. They can create, plus you have the Cam Newton factor. Carolina can manufacture different angles in the running game. I think they can negate some of the heavier, condensed defensive line sets that we've come to see from Arizona.
And I think with Arizona's roster, it's easy enough to run away from Calais Campbell. I mean, you've got five blockers along that Carolina offensive line who, well, a couple of them may be shady in the passing game, all of them can run block. All of them can drive guys off the ball. So when I look at Arizona, the guy that jumps out to me on run defense is Calais Campbell. After him, a lot of these runs, I think, are getting to the second and third level when they play some of these teams that are really committed to running the ball. But as you mentioned, they have a great run defense. The thing that really helps them is being so prolific on offense that so many teams that they've played have been forced to abandon the run by early third quarter.
Arizona is an undersized defense, and Carolina is a power running team. We got to just keep the 30,000-foot view in mind as well.
Totally, and that's fine. But when I talk about their run defense, I'm talking about an efficiency level. I mean, they're second in run defense DVOA. It's not a matter of just counting stats. They just make it happen, and they've been that way for a long time, and I think it's the way they're coached. And I think that just their scheme and the way that it works is very good against the run. But I think you're right, Andy, just in the sense that teams are going to attack them. This Carolina team is going to attack them differently than a lot of teams will. This Arizona, this is why this is like my favorite team in the NFL, just in terms of how they've been built. When you look at this depth chart on defense, Marcus Golden and Rodney Gunter are rookies. Gunter, who has been really solid for them all year after being picked in the fourth round out of Delaware State. And then outside of that, You have a converted safety as one of your inside linebackers. You have 87-year-old Dwight Freeney as one of your bench pass rushers. You used to have Tyrann Mathieu play like 17 positions. It's just a fascinating team. I've talked about how much I enjoy them many times, but this is one of those moments where you're considering how these teams got here, how they were built, that even really on both sides of the ball with these two teams, it's really an exercise in the way you're supposed to build. All right, I'm clearly getting too excited, so I think that is a sign that we should probably end this. But before we do, this is the time of year where we're supposed to pick a winner because it really matters. So let's start with the AFC. Who do you guys have?
I got New England.
Yeah, I think it's clear to everybody that the three of us are going with New England.
That works for me. Let's get to the NFC.
NFC, I'm going with Arizona, and I think what will be a higher scoring game than we would guess.
I will go with Carolina in a shootout, like Andy is suggesting here.
He's peeking at my paper.
I also think there will be a lot of points, and I also think that Arizona will win. So, Benoit, I think this is a hill that like you and I are going to die on. I feel like not a lot of people are picking the Cardinals, which is fine with me.
Are they not? Really? So we're all three picking Arizona, and we're all three picking New England. I picked Arizona at the front of the postseason. I didn't pick them anywhere near the front of the regular season, Carolina either. To me, they're the hardest team to play against schematically, and they have more talent than Carolina does, especially on offense.
I think if the Patriots play the Cardinals in the Super Bowl, the scoreboard will literally explode. So that is what I want to see. That is what I'm rooting for.
Let me say one thing. Personally, I think my gut is telling me that Arizona's going to win this game based on the matchups. But I would just love, I'm rooting for the story. You know, writers, we say we root for stories. I just like to see Cam Newton, after everything he's been through in his career, all the little mini controversies that probably shouldn't have been controversies, I'd like to see him on this stage.
I totally agree. Cam Newton in the Super Bowl would be amazing, and it'd be Cam Newton against Tom Brady. I think anything that involves either of these NFC teams and Arizona, or either of these NFC teams in New England, which I feel like we all think is going to happen, that's fine with me. So as long as we get that, I'm good to go. All right, I think that's all we got, guys. We'll be back, obviously, next week after these championship games to preview the big game.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.